Nau mai, haere mai, ki tēnei hōtaka. Welcome to the panel on RNZ National. Today, public submissions happened today on new gang laws, proposed gang insignia ban. The Free Speech Union joins us in just a minute. Also, a stoush over kāinga ora homes in Rotorua. One group says the steel containers are not fit for purpose in Rotorua and, well, they look horrible. And a large tree stump at a popular Nelson playground will be fenced off. Are we wrapping our kids in shagpile carpet? Plus, happy birthday Shakespeare, born on this day in 1564, gave us many nuggets in the English language, such as good riddance, break the ice, and knock knock who's there. What is a phrase or verse of Shakespeare that you have always, always remembered? Maybe from a drama, school, lectures. Text me 2101. You can email the panel at rnz.co.nz. With me, Alison Moore, founder of Access to Justice NGO Tika and former journalist. Alison, kia ora.
Kia ora.
And Ian Powell, now a health commentator, former executive director of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists. Alan, how are you?
I'm Ian, not Alan.
Oh, sorry, Ian. Sorry, Ian. My apologies.
Right. All right. I have an identity crisis. That's all right.
And so do I. Yeah, anyway, let's go to this. The Select Committee was discussing the proposed Gangs Legislation Amendment Bill, which would ban gang patches in public spaces as well as give police more powers to crack down on gangs. Submitters included former Black Power member and advocate Eugene Ryder, also the New Zealand Law Society, who said the legislation should be sent back to the drawing board. And according to former Mayor Michael Laws, who also submitted, who also ushered in a gang insignia ban, he said in Whanganui there was a 15% reduction in gang membership and gang association as a result of the bylaw. There were less gang-on-gang encounters. And also in the submitters was the Free Speech Union. They said that people are not retractable privileges. With us, Jonathan Ayling, Chief Executive of the Free Speech Union NZ. Jonathan, kia ora.
Very good evening.
Good to have you here, Jonathan. So you were the first up of many. Big day. How do you think it went?
Yeah, I think we were quite pleased with the presentations that we saw there. We were given the opportunity to hit it off and start what is a succession of a number of submissions from the Law Society and from the Human Rights Commission and other institutions, effectively saying a similar line, that gang crime is a problem in New Zealand and we need to deal with it. But by we don't do that by undermining basic civil liberties. And actually, I would say that unfortunately, censorship has a really terrible tendency to come back and bite us in the ways we didn't expect and often make things a lot worse. And I think that would be true in this case as well.
Just to be clear then, so symbols like gang patches and insignia are a form of expression intended to convey information in the same manner as speech? That's what you think?
Well, that's right. I think the right to expression and speech are both protected under the Bill of Rights Act here in New Zealand. And of course, by international treaties overseas as well. We do distinguish between speech and expression. Both matter. Probably speech relates to dialogue and the development of knowledge more than expression can at times, which can kind of be more monological in just one way. But in this case, we absolutely think that these expression rights are crucial to the way a society navigates difference. And look, I'm not here to defend gang members. I'm not here to defend their conduct. But I don't think that by undermining their rights, we are actually any safer or as a society any more cohesive.
Listeners, do you agree or not? Jump on into the conversation. 2101. Ellie, your thoughts, comments, questions here.
Yeah, quite a lot of the presenters at the Select Committee today appeared to be pointing out in various ways that this is unworkable, if you like. The government doesn't seem to have much of a problem with potential breaches of the Bill of Rights Act. They've been plain about that, or claims that they can get around them, or claims that the current bill in front of Parliament is not drafted well enough. So what's left is, will it work? And policing numbers appear to be the issue. I went back and had a look at the Sunday program segment from about a month ago, which concentrated on a porter key, which was in the news for gang activity a wee while ago. And they have two permanent police officers, frontline officers. They should have 12. One of the policemen who was currently on leave, who was interviewed, said they can't even attend all what he called the domestics, which is family violence call outs. So is it popular messaging from the government? Because unless they commit to more frontline policing in the regions, which they haven't done, it does not look like it's going to work.
So you're saying basically, Ellie, that it's quite possibly unenforceable on the ground?
Well, it's not me saying that. The police themselves are saying that. They don't have the people power to stop people in the street and remove their patched insignia. And, you know, the gangs themselves have said that if they try and do that, then there will be trouble. And there's not the police numbers to do that safely, I would argue.
I stay there, Jonathan. Ian?
I come at it from a slightly different perspective, but probably end up in the same place. I just think this is a classic form, a classic situation where the focus goes on symptoms rather than the cause. And my understanding is that overwhelmingly people are in gangs because they are marginalised for a range of reasons. And the focus should be on, you know, why are they marginalised and how can that be addressed? Now, when I was last on the panel about a month ago, I've been thinking, but I actually referred to this issue, and it was based on an experience of passing through and spending a bit of time in a park, a large park and recreational park, and there were two groups about 200 metres away from each other. One was at a kids' playground, families at a children's playground, and the other was a mongrel mob playing, having a touch rugby practice. Both were totally peaceful, and the only reason if someone was to be arrested, if this law was in place, was that because of the insignia that one group had rather than the other group. So, you know, I think that if you're going to charge or arrest or penalise people, it's got to be for what they do, not what they might wear as a form of identification.
What they do.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, what they might wear. Someone says, I agree with Jonathan Ayling and would add that patches themselves can act as a warning to people. Let me ask you, Jonathan, would your freedom of speech extend to all insignia, all symbols, even ones that society finds extremely objectionable?
I would say definitely, Wallace. The standard for the limitations on freedom of speech and freedom of expression are relatively sparse, and they must be quite bright. And that's why we've led a number of fights against really vague intents to stop offensive speech or offensive expression like hate speech. We would suggest that, you know, that age-old question around a swastika, for example. Look, and I have no interest whatsoever in providing any defence in the slightest for Nazis in our society. But if someone is inclined towards Nazi ideology, just as an example there, why would we want to push that underground where it festers and can ultimately take a far more
dramatic
expression?
Because it's a disgusting symbol, which is so highly offensive to sectors of society. It's got to be banned, surely, in our open streets, like it is in some other countries.
Absolutely not. We do not deal with things that are offensive by simply banning them. We deal with them by countering them, because otherwise what we do is we actually give the sense of grievance that legitimizes it within a very minority status. And what I would much rather do is defeat the debunked and absolutely worthless ideology that Nazism represents by countering it. We use speech to challenge bad ideas, not censorship.
What do you think, Alison?
Hate speech is, for somebody of my community, is a really personal subject. There are there are real harms done to marginalised communities from certain types of speech, is what I, and I'm talking about the LGBTQI plus yep. community here. There is real harm done when some people are permitted to espouse, you can't call anything but hate speech towards some sectors of the community. Mm.
Hey, just coming back to this, by the way, someone says gang patches are intended to intimidate the public, ban them. They represent crime and violence. Bring in the army. These idealists on your show need to get real. Now, Michael Laws, former mayor, he ushered in the localised gang patch ban. He said, when that patch is on, you're a different person. You have to be. You're a gang member and you're that gang. You assume that reputation. You're a one percenter and you exhibit that to the world. Take that patch off and you go back to being normal. We just want people to be normal again. What would you say to that, Jonathan? And then Ian?
I look, at a number of levels, Michael and I have disagreed on the subject several times. First of all, I would highlight the fact that the law that went through in Whanganui when Michael was mayor there was struck down by the High Court because the High Court decided that it was unacceptable in a society that was established with democratic norms. What Michael is pointing to is a question around identity. I would say it's pretty superficial to suggest that all the complexity and nuance that we deal with when engaging with the gang community is dealt with as soon as you remove a gang patch. That seems nonsense to me. I think the question around identity is a crucial one, and I would suggest it relates to what Ali is talking about there. Of course there are some perspectives that are hateful and harmful. There's no denying the fact that some speech can cause harm. The question that is far more interesting to me, though, is do we deal with that harm by silencing it, by suppressing it, by censoring it? And I would challenge you, Ali, specifically, show me a community internationally. Europe has a number of countries with hate speech laws where the very minority community that it was intended to be helped by hate speech laws does not become the target of censorship. I'm a straight white man. I don't need free speech. I've got right. privilege, according to some. I would suggest that the people that benefit from free speech are the minority communities who are often the ones that are then harmed by censorship.
We'll try and limit the discussion perhaps to the gang patch ban. You can feel free to jump in, Alison, if you want to, but shall we go over to a final comment from Ian?
Well, I don't think you can take an absolute abstract position on this. Gang patches are not something of themselves. They can cause some offence. They can be frightening, perhaps. But of themselves, they don't actually mean all that much other than a form of identification which people might not like. Some people might not like. I think the difference between that and this is where the relativity comes in, I guess, rather than absolutist, is the Nazi example, the Nazi symbol. That's a symbol of glorifying mass murder. And I think you can draw the line on issues like that. Drawing the line can be tricky at times, but there are some issues, I think, where it is pretty clear cut.
Such an interesting discussion. Jonathan, kia ora. Thank you for being with us today. That is Jonathan Ayling. He is the chief executive of the Free Speech Union of New Zealand, who put in a submission, first submission, and he said don't put a ban on gang insignia. It is 22 past 6. Alison Moore and Ian Powell with me today. Now, taking a look at Rotorua, which bucked a national consent slowdown. The surge of social housing in Rotorua has resulted in a record number of building consents for new homes. Now, one kāinga ora development in Rotorua has raised eyebrows, saying they're a bit shocked to see homes that look like shipping containers with glass at one end. But kāinga ora say the imported modules are not containers. And, by the way, not finished. They'll become stylish and modern homes when they are complying with all New Zealand standards. So with us is Tracy McLeod, who is a member of Emergency Housing Lobby Group Restore Rotorua. Tracy, good to have you here.
Good evening, Wallace.
So, yeah, look, as they stand, they do look almost exactly like white shipping containers with glass at one end. You cannot deny that. In fact, hard to just separate them out. But what do you think of these homes?
Well, they're the talk of the town at the moment.
Are they?
Yes, a lot of people, like you go into a shop, you know, and we're getting, as a group, Restore Rotorua is getting a lot of emails and phone calls from disgruntled residents just saying, what the hell are they? I mean, they're shocked, but they're really dismayed. And they feel deceived by Kāinga Ora because it was not not that long ago, on the 13th of March, they actually appeared at a Rotorua Lakes Council meeting. And they were trying to allay the fears of this mass building program that they've got happening in Rotorua at the moment. And they tried to reassure, you know, the councillors and the residents that they were doing a good quality job. But this has just blown it out of the water.
But hang on, you're a supporter of some, aren't you? Those Kāinga Ora developments on Lake Road, those new ones, they look quite stylish.
They're very styly, and I mean, Tony Bradley, he's a well-known developer in Rotorua. He's had years of experience, and they've used top-quality materials, and they're looking very stylish. So, I mean, it's on one side of town, you've got this very stylish development, which is going to be sold to Kāinga Ora, and then on the other side of town, you've got this eyesore.
Okay, let's bring our panel, Alison.
Well, I snort laughed when I read the story this morning, lying in bed in my gorgeous, warm, small, but beautiful home made of shipping containers.
Really?
Do you? I live in a shipping container house. I do. I do. And it is the warmest, most, well, it's just the nicest place I've ever lived.
Actual shipping containers?
Actual shipping containers, yes.
So whereabouts do you live in the part of the country?
I live in Auckland.
Right. So do you have sulphur up there or any geothermal activity?
Well, you'd have to explain to me how that impacts, because these houses, correct me if I'm wrong, they're plainly not finished. Are they, Tracy?
Yeah, no, they're not. But what we're sort of objecting to is, I mean, as a Rotorua local, everything, every metal in Rotorua rusts. So if you've got a garden shed, if you've got a TV aerial, if you've got tools, appliances, roofs, spouting, nails, they all rust in geothermal conditions. So that's why we're objecting to them.
Ellie.
Yeah, I live in a coastal area as well. And what I'm hearing is that people are objecting to them because they're ugly. And they're plainly not going to stay in the condition that they're in, right? I mean, I read the story. I saw the image of the finished product as projected, and it looks that they look beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, the finished product does look different to how they are at the moment. But what we're objecting to, or what people are concerned about, is the reaction to the sulphur, because it is Chinese steel, and we know that Chinese steel is actually inferior to New Zealand steel. So we're just worried about the longevity of the building. I mean, most buildings have a building life of 50 years in New Zealand. A shipping container has 25 years, and we're just worried about it in the geothermal district.
Kāinga Ora have pushed back on that. They've said, look, any rust or damage may have occurred during transport and will be rectified as the project is completed. And these are, as Ellie mentioned, specifically designed for steel structures to ensure durability in the environment in which they are built. That's what they'll say to you, Tracy. We've got Ian as well. Jump on in, Ian.
Well, I must admit, I did jolt a bit when I saw the first photographs in the new media report. But I agree with Alison. This is incomplete. It does look, as you see it, a bit ugly. I retract that. It does look ugly. But when you look at what it's intended to be, it actually doesn't look too bad at all. So I just wonder whether the rust is a different issue, and I'm not really in a position to comment on that. If it's an issue, then that's an issue that has to be addressed. But in terms of the optics of it, it seems to me to look not too bad. Now, in terms of where it's intended to end up. Now, the things that I would be concerned about would be, I like the idea of big windows. That means that these places are going to get sun. They're going to have to address privacy. There's got to be a reasonable amount of space around these constructions, these homes. I'm assuming, because it's a residential area, that it's access, you know, there is access to public transport and amenities and parks, etc. I think there are communal interest staircases. I don't have a particular view on that, but that's something that people might want to think about. But overall, I think that the criticism to me appears to be premature.
The other thing is that these buildings are actually one-bedroom buildings, and a lot of the families that are in emergency housing in Rotorua and the motels are actually families. So these are only one-bedroom units. The other concern that we have is that what about the fire exits from the top level?
So you've got a suite.
Oh, I think they're all fair questions that have to be sort of teased out. But I'm just sort of reacting to what I read.
Yeah. I guess on a wider issue, Tracy, I mean, there are nearly 900 individuals on the Ministry of Social Development's housing register in Rotorua. No shortage of people wanting a suitable place to live. Isn't it a good news story, the fact that actually Rotorua is getting its act together, can sense a buck in the trend are actually up, and when all is said and done, you may well have some, you know, some pretty high quality builds in the final instance?
Yeah, but will they be suitable for Rotorua? And the other thing that we want to know is that Kāinga have said that 12% of their houses are built off-site. Okay, the ones in the first stage were actually manufactured in a factory over in Huntly. So they're traditional style, you know, with your weatherboards and your metal roof and everything. And, I mean, they're lovely homes, and that's in the first stage. But, I mean, this is a contrast to what has been done in the first stage. And the other thing is that Kāinga Ora misled the community by saying that there would be jobs given to local tradespeople, that they'd be using all the sub-trades and the builders and that in Rotorua to help construct these homes. And then what they've done is they've shipped them in from offshore in China. So there's a whole lot of other wraparound issues around these container houses. It's not just the optics.
Well, it's good to have you on, Tracy, and we'll see if Kāinga Ora would like to come on and address a couple of those issues. But for now, kia ora, appreciate your time. That's Tracy McLeod, member of Emergency Housing Lobby Group, Restore Rotorua there. Back to you, Ali, and your shipping container house. Well, how about
it's
that?
It's got glass all around, just like those do, and that allows the sun in. You have to wear slippers in winter, Wallace, if you ever come and visit, because it's mainly a tiled floor, and it's not. I don't have underfloor heating, but that's a very small, you know, and not really a problem. And it's wonderful because it doesn't have a roof to blow off in a cyclone, I can tell you that. And,
right.
And where I was, we were particularly badly hit last year. So I can't speak highly enough of shipping container houses.
And on a cold night, on a cold Auckland night, Ali, warm?
Yeah, because I have a wood burner. And the house is small enough to be completely heated by that.
Oh, that's so cool. Very cool. And look, as you say, some of them, they can look very, very, very stylish, very nice, very good. I grew up in Rotorua for 20 years with a hot spring in my backyard. No rust, calm down. It is it's 28 to 7, the panel, NZ National. Keep your thoughts coming. We're going to be talking about Shakespeare in a minute because it's his birthday, born 460 years ago. Is there one phrase or verse that you have always remembered? You took part in a school play. You might have been in King Lear, as Jesse Mulligan was. You might have been in The Tempest. You might have been in, what's another one? Hamlet. And there's always that phrase you record. What is it? 2101, email the panel at rnz.co.nz. Evie Ashton, what about you in your Shakespearean play?
Out, damp spot.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there. especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.